Okay, everybody, I hope you've really enjoyed your meal and you're probably just about to head into your dessert course. We've fed your bodies, now we want to feed your mind. How about that? I'd like to introduce our speaker today. I'm going to read from this to save time. This is the biography for Dean Richard Rausch. Rick Rausch's career in sustainable agriculture spans research, teaching, extension, regulation, and administration in both the USA and Australia. Trained as an entomologist in the University of California, Rick earned his BS at the University of California, Davis, and PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, prior to joining the College of Agricultural Sciences at Penn State, where he is the dean. And that occurred in October of 2014. He served as Dean of the Melbourne School of Land and Environment at the University of Melbourne. Before that, Director of the University of California's Integrated Pest Management and Sustainable Agriculture Programs. Before that, Director of the Cooperative Research Center on Australian Weed Management based at the University of Adelaide in Australia. And prior to that, he also served as an associate professor at Mississippi State and Cornell Universities. Rick's research has focused on strategies to slow insect pests and weeds from evolving resistance to genetically modified insect-resistant crops and pesticides, but also on the biological control of pests. He's worked extensively on crops as diverse as potatoes, wheat, corn, cotton, alfalfa, grapes, almonds, cocoa, and coffee, and in natural ecosystems across the USA and Australia and the Pacific Islands, and in India and in China. At Penn State, Rick has particularly focused on key issues facing agriculture and rural communities in Pennsylvania, including food safety regulations, water quality, diversification of agriculture, obesity, diabetes, and drug addiction. And Dean Rausch is here to speak to us today on with a very interesting title of his presentation, Genetically and Modified Crops, Economical and Safe for Food and the Environment? Well, I think we're going to find out. Rick, thank you.
Thank you. So I want to thank Kevin and Mike for pursuing me for about this. I wasn't necessarily the best email correspondent, but they were persistent. We got it worked out.
Oh, you were good.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. So one particular salient part of my biography to talk today is that while I was the director of the National Weed Research Center Australia from 1998 to 2003, I was also appointed to the Australian Government Committee on Regulating GM Crops called Genetic Manipulation Advisory Committee, which was purely advisory, but nobody actually violated any of the recommendations we made. So, like many of you, I railed against regulators much of my life at that point. I looked in the mirror one morning and realized I was one. That was a sobering thing. And then I moved back from there to the University of California, where for 4 years I was in charge of not only the Integrated Pest Management Program, but also Sustainable Agriculture Program. And so I had principal extension responsibilities for organic agriculture. So it was a kind of an interesting switch in terms of things I've had to do in my background. So today I was asked to take on these issues, and I know that this is part of a series you have on challenges in agriculture of the 21st century and beyond. My short version is that the real challenges we have include water. It's estimated that by 2030, which is not that far away, there'll be water shortages of about 40 to 50% the world for agricultural production. Conservation of soil, because still one of the greatest challenges we have in agriculture is just erosion. But the other thing is, sooner or later, we have to worry about nutrients. We can keep making nitrogen, we've got enough energy by pulling it out of the air by the Haber-Bosch process. But sooner or later, since phosphorus is basically a mineral, sooner or later, whether it's 50 years to hit peak phosphorus or 600, sooner or later, we're going to think about how to manage phosphorus. And we probably ought to start doing it sooner rather than later. Human resources are going to be a big challenge. So around the world, more and more people are moving away from the land into cities. We have to be concerned that we get enough students into agriculture, really learning the cutting edge of agriculture. Energy is going to be a huge challenge. And a big question is, can we manage to grow agriculture to the extent that it has to be grown while not doing any more damage to the environment? So these are, let's see, some of the really big challenges no matter what. Nonetheless, you'll often hear people quote figures to the effect that we have to increase agricultural production in the world by about 70 to 100% for another 3 billion people between now and 2030. Some people would dispute those figures. If we go to a diet that's much less based on animal protein, we can buy a bit less. The nutritionists I've heard talk, they've tried lots of things to try to make sure that during the first couple of years of life, children have enough protein in the diet, and they try as they may, everywhere they work around the world, they can't incorporate some animal protein in the diet. They've said it's basically a failure to go strictly vegetarian diet, so there probably have to be something. Nonetheless, one of the simple facts is that when I was born in 1954, there was roughly something on the order of half a hectare, so this is about an acre of land for every person in terms of food production. And during my lifetime, that's dropped in half. So we've got, you know, we've got this about 7 or 8 billion people. The amount of arable land is about half, a quarter of a hectare, about half an acre. So in my lifetime, it's dropped 50% because the growing population, and also the loss of some agricultural lands to urbanization, salinity, dry land aridity. I mean, it's one of the ironies that cities are always built in places where you get farmland, and then we paved over the best farmland that usually had water. Look at Philadelphia. So we've got real challenges about whether we're going to produce enough food going in the future, which inevitably says that unless we're going to cut down more rainforests and somehow otherwise cultivate more of the tropics, we've got to think about how to intensify agriculture and do it more efficiently. And that would be one of the first things we have to do to reduce the impacts on the environment. So if I were to focus more narrowly on the kinds of issues that I usually think about for agriculture in terms of health and environmental sustainability, they include conservation of soil and water, for quality and quantity. So Pennsylvania is not usually quality, but it's a quantity issue. As a lot of what we work on at Penn State now is trying to help reduce agricultural runoff and urban stormwater runoff that might end up in Chesapeake Bay. Energy use, you know, reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. And Kevin's been working on this his whole career. Reduce use of what might be called bad actor pesticides. I think realistically, we won't get rid of pesticides altogether. But there's certainly some that are more worrisome than others. We want to get those out of the picture. We want to try to reduce the presence of toxins and pollutants in the food supply. We want to improve economic and social systems, and we want healthier foods. Sound like a pretty good list of things to aim for? That's what keeps me awake at night. So the first commercially available GM crops, what I hope to show you, the ones that have already been developed have actually addressed many of these criteria already, even though people haven't known about it. And I should say, to start off with, when I first heard about GM crops, I was a skeptic. I was working on how to delay the evolution of resistance to insecticides in insects. And one of the fundamental tenets of about three or four key things we want to do is avoid persistent exposure to any given toxin. So when I first heard in about 1990, Monsanto had put BT genes, I'll tell you more about this in a minute, into crops, and they were going to have continuous exposure. I thought it was a terrible idea. I really thought my job was going to be trying to figure out how to take a bad situation, at least turn it into something somewhat manageable. It turns out it's a bit better than that. But I was very skeptical about these things to start with. In any case, the crops that are out there so far really had their origin about that time. Most of the working prototypes of these were developed in about 1986 to 1996. And very few things that, well, I'll give you a couple of exceptions at the end of my talk, but essentially all the crops that have been released today have their prototypes way back then, over 20 years ago, with only a couple that have gotten into the pipeline since. And a lot of that's because of the resistance of activist groups and really intense regulation. But the crops that were available so far includes ones that include genes modeled on those from Bacillus thuringiensis. I'll explain that a bit later. Herbicide tolerance, the big one being Roundup resistance, but not the only one. Much overlooked, but closely related to this, is the fact that you can make hybrid crops out of GM. So corn is a huge crop over 100 million acres in North America, and almost all of it is hybrid. If we take two different lines, crops can get hybrid vigor and so forth. But most other crops can't do that. I'll show you an example later that shows that because now we understand more about pollination biology, we can make sterile hybrid lines out of a lot of other crops and do the hybrid corn trick and a lot of other things. And it's actually important for pest management, weed management. Virus resistance, I'll give the classic, the great example really is papaya in Hawaii, but around the world, particularly in the tropics, virus diseases in crops are really important for food crops like cassava. Typically, these viruses are removed by insects, aphids, and leafhoppers, and about the only way you can usually control them, in addition to having clean seed to start with, is a spray like mad to kill the aphids or leafhoppers that transmit them. So it's a big deal as well. So those are the ones that have gotten out to some extent or another already. GM crops have spread at an enormous rate, and it's the most widely adopted technology probably in the history of agriculture.
If you imagine, if you see that really the first GM crops of any, the first GM crops of real note got out in about 1996, so they started out at about zero here, and they're now grown on more than 180 million hectares, more than 400 million acres. So it's a pretty dramatic increase. It's something like 20% of the world's total arable land. It's an enormous figure. Now, a lot of people would think that the United States was the first place to introduce GM crops. Do you think that's true? You'd be wrong. China did it 3 years before we did, and with virus-resistant tobacco, which just illustrates that this technology is available to everybody. It's not that difficult to do it. But still, it was a pretty dramatic increase. You can see from this map of the countries that are participating, and includes particularly India and China, which are key, as I'll talk about in a moment. At least 28 countries have continued to plant biotechnology crops. There's over 400 million acres, and it includes some 17 or 18 million farmers, most of whom are in China and India. So this is what cotton looks like in Australia. This is one that I was involved in where we, to help preserve the long-term sustainability of the insect-resistant cotton, we insist that growers plant some cotton acreage that doesn't express BT at all. But this is a really handy slide that illustrates the impact of what this is. In Australia, if you didn't use insecticides or BT cotton, you couldn't grow a crop in most years. The crop gets completely stripped. In fact, because we're standing in Uniqlo, I ought to point out that during the Civil War, the British bereft of the cotton production from the southern United States tried to get it replaced by what they could grow in Australia, and the cotton bollworms beat them. They could produce a cotton crop in Australia because of these insects. So back in the 1930s, it was discovered that certain strains of a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis produced something that killed insects, particularly caterpillars. And they were often very specific to some groups of caterpillars. And over the years, it was worked out that this was due to these parasporocrystal bodies, as they're called, that are really a crystallized form of insecticidal protein that's very specific. The insects attack them with their gut and cause the gut to basically break up and dissolve. And they also have these parasporal bodies that allow the spores to reproduce, the bacteria to reproduce after dry periods. So you get these crystals. So in the early days of genetic engineering, the 1980s, this was one of the first targets where people tried to figure out what's going on at the molecular level with this protein. How does it work? What caused them? And they mapped and cloned the genes really on. They're relatively small as genes go. So early on, people thought this would be a really great idea if we could put these in plants. And when there were finally breakthroughs when you could put genes in plants, this is one of the first things people looked to try to do. Really led first by a group in Belgium. And they tried it on a variety of insects. One of the crops that isn't used anymore is potatoes, but it was designed really to control the Colorado potato beetle, native to the United States, but so famous that even the Austrians put a postage stamp together for them. And this shows some of the first trials on Long Island, where these are potatoes that are carrying BT gene, and these are potatoes that were not. And a lot of that is protecting them from damage from Colorado potato beetles, especially the larvae. This is a crop that's no longer grown in the United States, because even though it was introduced for a couple of years, it was very effective. They also put virus resistance in it, to the point that we could grow potatoes in New York, which had historically been treated about 10 times a year. Colorado potato beetle, one of the most rapidly evolving species for the evolution of resistance. Basically, you could control insect pests and viruses without spraying. You just had to control weeds. So what happened? There was the prospect of consumer revolt against McDonald's and Simplot, a couple of the other major producers and marketers of potatoes, and they backed off. So, and the result has been we control these pests now, not by biological means, but by soil applications of an insecticide called imidacloprid, one of the neonicotinoids that people are concerned about these days in terms of effect on bees and everything else. So that's what the trade-off. We got rid of a GM crop, but we replaced it with insecticide. But there are a lot of environmental benefits of GM crops, including reduction in tillage, reducing CO2 emissions by 20 billion pounds a year, most of it because of better carbon storage in the soil. So when you turn soil over all the time, you keep exposing carbon to soil, and some of it volatilizes off or metabolizes off into CO2 and goes to the atmosphere.
No-till is great for keeping water in the soil, keeping carbon in the soil. If you're not dragging steel through the soil to kill weeds or till the soil, you save a lot of energy from doing that. So one of the biggest advantages of Roundup-ready crops around the world is dramatic reduction in tillage. And sometimes you can see the effects of it. First time I walked up to a Roundup-ready cotton field in Georgia, the thing that really amazed me was there'd just been a big rainstorm and there was no mud going through the tailwater because they hadn't relied on tillage. So these are big things.
It's been estimated by particularly Jorge Fernandez Caneo, who's an Economic Research Service economist with the USDA. He's the person who did most of this work and kept track of the benefits around the world for introducing these crops. The benefits in terms of reducing what I call bad acting pesticides are probably most dramatic in cotton, as I'll show you in a moment. But the general reduction in persistent pesticide use has been on the order of 5 to 70%, depending on the crop. And this is equivalent to about 40% of the pesticide use of the entire European Union they got by the introduction of GM crops. The average is about 16% less than non-GM crops as counterparts. There's been increased yield in billions of pounds and about $5 billion a year in cost savings. Crops are reduced. Essentially, it's from about 2000 to present. So this was one that really caught my attention. So I got into entomology I was a genetics major at UC Davis. Before one summer, I happened to pick up by accident Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and read the book in 3 days and changed my major in entomology. And I went into cotton because at the time, 50% of all the world insecticide use was solely on cotton because of the kinds of pest problems it suffers. And I deliberately looked for a job in Mississippi, of all places, because that's where the hotbed of doing things like cotton was. And they were doing things that really they spent decades trying to breed cotton varieties that resisted the major cotton tests without a whole lot of success. So I had actually moved to Cornell by the time these field trials were planned, but went back to Mississippi to visit my friends and look at what's going on. So these are the first time I saw BT cotton in the field. And this was a Delta Pine variety without the BT gene, and this was an isogenic Delta Pine variety with the BT gene. So these are back cross, but they're genetically identical except for the presence or absence of BT. And you can see the difference of what was happening. So in the United States and Australia, 70 to 90% reduction in insecticide applications. And when you stop spraying for the cotton bollworms, it meant there were lots of other non-chemical things you could do for the other pests in cotton. If you're going to spray 10 times a year, as they had to do in Australia for cotton bollworms, why would you bother doing any biological controls for the other pests? So it just opened up the opportunities to get further reductions on other technologies. But the biggest beneficiaries by far would be those millions of farmers I talked about in China and India. The Chinese government has done a really good job of documenting this and showed that the reductions in pesticide exposures to people were on the order of 80% or so, and that the number of pesticide poisons and deaths resulting in dropped dramatically. 1996, before when I went to China the first time, before BT cotton was introduced, it was estimated that 400 to 1,000 people a year died from occupational exposure to cotton insecticides, and tens of thousands remained sick. By 2000, after the introduction of BT cotton, it virtually disappeared, documented by Chinese government. So people are still spraying a lot less, and with a lot less dangerous things. And similarly in India. In fact, in India, before India plants the most cotton acreage of any country in the world, that also had about the lowest per hectare yields. The introduction of BT cotton in the space of 5 years converted India from a net importer of cotton to a net exporter, just because it improved their yields. In some areas, it improved the yields by 80% of minimal insecticide use. So this is what was happening beforehand. This is actually in India. People would mix things up like this. You can
admire all the body protection they're using to keep those pesticides off.
But also in other places, this is a slide from Australia where I was working. So we introduced BT cotton on limited acreage in this cotton growing season, 1996-97, and held it to just under 30% of the area for the first few years for purposes of trying to delay resistance, so I won't go into it right now. But we only had it out there for 3 years. Growers planted next to towns, and they planted next to rivers, the areas where they were most sensitive to pesticide use. And within 4 or 5 years' time, completely eliminated the ability to detect insecticides like M. sulfate in the rivers. So it made that big a difference, even before it went countrywide. Now, I'd give you a whole other talk about how we've worked on the sustainability of this technology, but I won't. I'll just show you one slide. So a lot of the work I did was to research and document the
putting two different BT genes into plants and leaving some of the plants unexposed was the most effective way we have at present to delay resistance. And we did these experiments in the diamondback moth, a common pest of cabbages and other cruciferous vegetables, evolved resistance to BT sprays in Hawaii and Georgia and other places. In fact, it went through two different kinds of BT sprays. Ones that had a gene called Cry1A and other ones that relied on a gene called Cry1C. So we were able to get the genes. The crop Monsanto actually gave us the Cry1A gene. And we had strains that were resistant to them that we collected in Georgia and Florida and other places. There's work I did at Cornell with my colleague, Trent Shelton. And I was gifted at Cornell that one of the people in plant sciences was an expert on transforming brassicas. So the cauliflower's one. So she made BT broccoli for me, for us, for the work we did. So this shows what happens if you pyramid. You put the two genes together. We selected them in large greenhouse cages for 24 generations without getting resistance. If we planted them where some of them had Cry1A or some of them had Cry1C and there was still a refuge, we wiped them out in 12 generations. So this is the kind of thing we recommend people don't do in the field. We try to get companies to coordinate the releases so they have got competing varieties with different genes out there at the same time. And if we went with one followed by the other, we wiped out the first one, we were demanded only on the second one at the end of the experiment. So this and a bunch of other modeling so forth was the basis of recommendations that have been largely adopted in the United States and Australia to only release these BT crops with two BT genes in them. Unfortunately, in other countries, they haven't done it. Now we've got resistance problems in at least six other countries. Right now, the biggest problem is in Brazil.
So the bottom line, though, when you start looking at this from an economic standpoint, is that GM crops have benefited growers everywhere around the world where they've been grown, which accounts for their rapid adoption. In fact, it was illegal to grow Roundup-ready soybeans in Brazil for several years. And in the southern states of Brazil, the growers saw what was going on in Argentina, crossed the river, bought seed, brought it back, and started planting it, even though it was illegal. 30% of the Brazilian soybean crop was GM and was being exported to Europe. And the government was unable to stop it because the growers just said, this is working for us, we're going to use it. India probably still wouldn't have a GM crop today if it wasn't that somebody bootlegged some, in fact, we think we even did it, bootlegged some seeds out of some Monsanto trials in India, incorporating their own cottonseed varieties, and started growing it. And at one point, Monsanto became aware that there was a lot of cotton in the state of Gujarat that was doing pretty well in a high bollworm. So they went out, collected some of the leaves, tested them, and had their gene in it. So it was Monsanto who reported the Indian government that the crop had got out and it had nothing to do with it. At first, there were calls the Bernalos crop gap. About that time, I went to go visit an agriculture university at Dharwad, which is basically a cotton university. That's what they work on primarily. And I talked to cotton growers, mostly to translators, and asked them what they thought about this. And they said, if the government's going to come and try to take us away from it, we're going to have a ride on their hands. This is better than we've been lied to about how bad this would be, that this crop is helping us out. We're healthier, we're growing profitable cotton. So basically, these are two examples of the crop spread into new countries actually being resisted by Monsanto. There was actually commercial reasons they didn't want this to happen, and it happened anyhow, really because of grower revolt. So the crops have been spreading themselves, and probably are doing the same thing throughout Southern Africa right now. Becca. These conclusions aren't mine. This was done by what you think would be the most critical organization in the world about this, the European Commission's Joint Research Center. Where else would you take a more critical view of this than Europe? But they couldn't find anything wrong. And in fact, it's a popular myth that Europe rejects GM crops. For at least a dozen years, they've been importing GM soybeans primarily from Argentina and Brazil, 30 million tons. They don't require labeling of any of the food produced from it. Several countries have grown it, and Spain continues to grow at least 100,000 hectares, worth 250,000 acres a year of BT corn against the European corn borer, just as we do in the northern tier states, just as you do in Pennsylvania. And the Joint Research Center looked at the safety of foods in 2008, and said there was no demonstration of any health effect of GM products submitted to the regulatory process. They couldn't find anything wrong. In fact, I ran into a European regulator who I had some email correspondence with from time to time in a meeting in India about this stuff, and he had just retired. And off the record, I said, why did you do this? They spent something like 300 million euros looking into this, trying to find something wrong with it. He said, there was a political imperative for us to find something wrong. And so it's done everybody else a great service, because you looked at this harder than anybody thought was possible and still couldn't find anything. So in terms of how do we make GM crops, in terms of thinking about their safety, Usually what's involved is there's a key gene that makes a protein of some kind, like the BT genes I talked about earlier. It's hooked up to a gene promoter, typically from a plant virus. So a common one used in a lot of these transformations is a particular gene, now the cauliflower mosaic virus, that does a pretty good job of expressing genes in any plant they put it into. So we eat cauliflower mosaic virus all the time. In fact, we probably had some with lunch today in the broccoli. Because it's extremely widespread. So this is not the entire virus we're putting in plants, it's just one promoter. And so that we transfer the genes we transfer the genes by a bacteria called Agrobacterium, which causes crown gall, or by a biolistic technique. So also in the 1980s, people worked out what was called causing crown gall, and it has this bacteria called Agrobacterium. And essentially, it's a naturally occurring genetic engineer. And I'll show you in the next slide. What Agrobacterium has is it has, in addition to the most of its chromosomes, it has these secondary bits of DNA in a cell called a plasmid. And it's got genes on it, on the plasmid, and when it gets into a plant, it releases some of these genes into the plant DNA, and it basically takes over the plant's DNA to make this big gall. It's got a lot of Agrobacterium in it, diluted, like plum trees, for example. So scientists worked out how to use the same machinery and transform other plants, like tomato and tobacco were about the easiest ones, the first ones people did. So that's how they did it to start with. They transfer the genes and they regrow little bits of tissue, isolated tissue called cow's tissue, they regenerate it until they can grow them up to the point where they can get the flower to grow seeds, then they can take off and make more plants out of it. So there was a guy at the Geneva Experiment Station at Cornell while I was at Ithaca in New York, and he came up with a completely wacky idea. So when I was an undergraduate taking the next, they told us that where genes are in an organism is really important to their expression. And if they get moved to other places, it may not work right. Well, apparently John didn't read any of this literature, because he didn't hear anything about that, because he thought, I'm just going to try putting DNA genes I'm interested in on little particles of tungsten or gold. He basically sawed off a .22 rifle, shook out the slug and the powder, and just used the primer to launch the stuff into cow's tissue, undifferentiated cow's tissue. When I heard that he was doing this, and like most of my friends, he said, Don, no, that can't possibly work. Well, it did. And it came for Cornell's best ever patent. It's called biolysis. So you blast the DNA into the cells. Some of it gets taken up by the chromosomes anyhow and expresses properly. You keep shutting the ones that don't work very well. And that made it possible not only to do corn, crops that we had done before, like tomatoes and cotton, but also do corn, because agrobacterium didn't work. So away it went. So the way they make Roundup Ready soybeans, in contrast to the BT case I talked about, is that Roundup works on an enzyme in the plant called EPSPS. So it binds the EPSPS and it stops it from making three amino acids, just three particular amino acids. Without those amino acids, the plant can't form proteins properly. So how many people have used Roundup in their garden? Yeah, almost everybody has. And what happens? When you spray Roundup, the plant fall over the next day? Now it takes like weeks before it finally dies. In fact, usually it's a bacterial infection, an opportunistic bacterial infection that finally kills the plant. It takes so long to die because the plant's basically being starved to death, right? Not being able to make its protein. Well, we don't make amino acids. So in the first phase, that's one of the reasons why Roundup ought to be not toxic to us, because we don't make amino acids, we get them out of food. It's only to affect plants. So this EPS is present in all plants in one form or another. So we're eating it all the time. And it turns out that there are some forms of EPS from plants and bacteria that aren't very sensitive around it. So after various trial and error of other things, Monsanto happened on this idea and took EPSPS from, guess what, Agrobacterium, because they had it grown in the lab already, and found it had EPSPS. They tried it. It was pretty insensitive. And they used that in the plants. So now the plant's got its own EPSPS. It's got this other one that comes from Agrobacterium, or it could come from petunias. They're also pretty insensitive. So we treat them with Roundup. The plant's own version of EPSPS gets jammed up. There's another one there that can carry on making the acids, and so the crop can still grow. And one of the clues, the match of these two forms of enzyme has to be really close, is if this didn't work really well, the other one couldn't substitute for the one the plant had already, and you see significant yield problems, which we don't get. And that's why Roundup Ready soybeans is a dominant transgenic crop in the world, because it protects the plant against Roundup use, but has no yield impacts. So it just basically uses its sensitive forms. There we go. So that brings me to the question I often get asked, isn't this unnatural? And it really sort of hits me because I would train as an entomologist. We have a vast literature in entomology about how plants make all kinds of things, it seems, primarily to defend themselves from herbivores like insects and us. So you look at plants ordinarily, you know, the history of modern of agriculture over the last 10,000 years, it has been defined, it's been defined plants and to eliminate the compounds that defend them against herbivores or defenses against herbivores, and also to make the things more harvestable, but the seeds don't shatter so you can harvest them. That's been the primary thing we've done. But it's made things a lot unnatural. They're completely anti-evolutionary, right? The seeds want to shatter, the plants want to defend against herbivores, so we push them in a direction that's not consistent with their evolution. So an example you'll see grown locally is prickly lettuce. You're bound to find some of this on abandoned fields and so forth. Oops, I'm back up. So that's the ancestor of the lettuce we might have in salad, okay? So if you find some prickly lettuce one day, you'll find it's got lots of little spikes all over, you break a leaf, it has lots of white goo that comes out that's the latex, and all those are protecting themselves against herbivores like us. And we got rid of it to make that. But probably the most dramatic tour de force of breeding in history is corn. We took a grass called teosinte, it has just two rows of seeds and grows about that tall. And through tour de force of breeding from peoples who had no written language, it appears they selected about five major genes or gene regions to create that. And all this diversity. Something that grows 9 feet tall sometimes, has various funny colors, whites, reds, greens, all kinds of other colors of corn. And it seems, you know, basically there's been a lot of strong selection occurred during that time period. Wheat, a lot of wheat varieties are actually hybrids of two species that people probably discovered by accident, selected in the field. So no, it's not natural. So this just brings to mind that one of the challenges we had looking at regulatory questions for GM crops, people kept saying, well, you've measured lots of things, but how can you be sure that one of these transgenes hasn't jumped in someplace where it's disrupted the function of some other gene and it's going to cause something bad to happen? Okay? And that bothered me for a long time. The only case I know of where this happened, it was actually an agronomic problem. So when Monsanto first tried to go to the field with BT cotton, they released a variety where the bolls turned out to be about a quarter too small and the yield was a quarter less. They had to go back to the lab and find some more transformants, as they call it, until they found one that didn't do that. But it just seems to be that in one case, it did drop into a gene that was important to yield. But what about food? So that's what one day I thought about Barbara McClintock, who toiled in obscurity during most of her research career, never had a professorial position anywhere, but won the Nobel Prize in 1983 because she discovered jumping genes. So she was tediously working away, showing that lots of genes had been mapped in corn, and showing that in some crosses and so forth, things went haywire, things didn't map where they were supposed to map anywhere. So she discovered jumping genes. It was only later that we understood that plants have an enzyme called transposase that causes these transposable elements to move around, especially when you get crosses occurring between varieties. There are thousands of genes jumping into other places in corn all the time, and we don't worry about it. Nobody regulates this, never been followed. But we know from Barbara McClintock's work dating back in the 40s that it was happening. We just only recently figured it out. So corn's been grown all the time. Nobody's asked what's the human safety implications of this banging around the genes. And it's happening in spades in corn. The other thing is that if you have any pasta wheat, all pasta wheat varieties are derived from some that were bred by radiation breeding. That is to say, in a probably ill-conceived effort to generate more variation in plants. It does, but not very well. Wheat varieties were being irradiated. So this is a site in Japan where they were doing some rice and other crops. So in the middle of a big, in the middle, this is an area surrounded by a 25 foot tall dike, and that's a cesium-60 radiation source, so you don't want to spend any time here. And they've got all these crops growing here, exposing them to radiation during their growth. This is in Japan, by the way. So they did all this radiation and dry crops from it. So if you eat pasta wheat, you've eaten food that's had been hammered by genetic engineering. We don't know all the kinds of mutations that occurred, but we eat it all the time. Nobody's ever demanded any regulation of it. Okay, so even without that kind of background, the European Union looked at, you know, the safety of foods from GM, as I alluded to earlier, and they published in 2010 this report, 130 studies, 300 million euros, that's what I mentioned earlier, and they couldn't find anything wrong with it. Every GM crops, the safety of GM crops that have been released today commercially have been judged safe by every major scientific medical organization in the world. And that's, and the US National Academy of Sciences said, it's actually safer than mutation breeding by any kind of measure, which has never been regulated. Okay, so I have to put this slide in here because it reminds me of something. On one hand, it's going to be unhealthy. Because people always talk about how this is unnatural, it's artificial, and so forth. There is, in fact, an artificially produced food that's in the human food supply that's directly associated with major health risks such as heart disease. What is it? What? This is a food that's dangerous, it's artificial, it's in the food supply. There isn't a big public campaign about it. You can't, you know what it is?
Salt.
Trans fats. Hydrogenated, partially hydrogenated fats. We chemically modify them so they're partially hydrogenated, and they keep Oreo cookies lasting longer, right? So where is the big campaign against something that's truly artificial and dangerous as hell, really? We should have it out of the food supply instead of a campaign directed against GM crops. Well, people have, in Australia, they have started banning trans fats, and at least they're getting away with that in the United States. But it always amazed me that we've got Mr. Chase the wrong thing. So, and there are some benefits from GM crops. This is BT corn. So when the first BT corn was nominated for release in the United States, I actually wrote to the EPA and opposed its registration because the company, Steve Guide, or somebody here at East Work, made a submission and basically dismissed resistance management as being a kind of concern, and they were doing stupid. It was going if I was going to do something, I wanted to select resistance quickly, and the insects, I would do exactly what they were proposing. So I opposed the first corn, but I didn't think it was really that useful because I was really focused on crop, where most of the insecticide use is, and particularly the Helicoverpa zea, the cotton bollworm. It's also the corn earworm. It's also the sorghum headworm, tomato fruitworm. Corn is one of its major host plants. It's called zea because a Mississippi cotton farmer realized that its primary host plant was corn, even though it was test working in cotton. So what I was concerned about is what if we make all this corn out there transgenic? That knocks out a wonderfully big refuge for delaying resistance in cotton. And for what? And what were we going to get out of it? You know, protect the ears, a little bit of the ear of corn that's going into grain? What would be the point? Minimal economic benefit compared to what the implication of cost would be for cotton. So I wasn't crazy about this at all. What changed my mind eventually was the fact that there was much lower levels of one of the most carcinogenic natural compounds we know, fumonisins, which is a big cause of esophageal cancer. And this was work, cut off the bottom of the page just a little bit here. And I can't quite read the bottom label, but this is work done by Gary Monkwald, who was a plant pathologist at Iowa State, not by Monsanto. Gary Monkwald had been working on fumonisins and other mycotoxins, and he saw what this corn was doing and reasoned that it would probably have much lower levels of fumonisins because it stopped corn earworm from doing, and European corn borer from doing damage to corn kernels. And the damaged corn kernels and the fracks, the waste produced by the caterpillars, was a perfect substrate. And so he said, well, if we have less damage to corn kernels, we have lower fumonisin levels. And he was right. So he went out and did these, you know, this is a graph from his paper. He went out and did these studies and took Monsanto's yield guard, compared to non-BT varieties in two different years, and you could see much lower levels of fumonisin. So you don't get that sort of stuff happening anymore. So, you know, in humans, it isn't usually a problem in the United States as all the corn gets checked. So when the bin of corn comes up to Wenger's and you're in Harrisburg, they go out and put a couple plungers in there, pull out, check the corn fumonisin level. It keeps going through the processing, but they pull it back and get rid of it if it actually had fumonisin levels. They don't find it, especially now we've got a lot of BT corn growing out there. But if there are high levels of fumonisin, particularly on farm, it's an animal welfare issue because it causes problems with them too. But where does the corn go to? It's got fumonisin levels. It doesn't go in the human food chain. What do you do with it? It goes out to the pigs and the cows, and especially in places like Africa. This said, there have been problems recently. About 10 years ago, there was an outbreak of spina bifida among Mexican-American women on the border because they were making tortillas, and tortillas was laced with too much fumonisin. So it's not trivial. It competes with rival flavor. So So in Africa, I should back up. In Africa, this is really a big deal. So that during drought years in particular, when they don't have very much corn, they save everything to eat everything. Before AIDS, the primary cause of mortality and morbidity in Africa was esophageal cancer from corn. It only worked out about 15 years ago. So this is the case where GM crops are actually healthier to eat instead of being neutral. So the other one I want to talk about is papaya ring spot virus. So the resistance to this was developed by Dennis Gonzalez, who is an Hawaiian of Portuguese descent, as most of the papaya growers are, on the Big Island. About 1994, ring spot virus died in Hawaii, and it moves around like native, it moved around by native, it was really too early. And so they started losing all their papayas to this stuff. It's called ring spot because it makes these characteristic ring spots on the fruit. It causes the shoestringing of the leaves, and in a couple of years kills the plant. So Dennis got interested in this, and he followed up on work that was being done at the Ithaca branch of Cornell by Milt Zaitlin and his colleagues, where they showed you could take small pieces of the coat protein of the virus, put it in the plant, and it would resist the virus. It was due to a process called gene silencing. So the plant sees too much copy of something in there, it silences everything like that. And he showed that you could take a remarkably small fragment of coat protein, like 100 bases in 90%. So it was a tour de force of molecular biology as well as breeding, because this was his first field trials in Hawaii in 1995-97. Now, I have a fortunate circumstance of knowing Dennis because he was a colleague 60 miles away from me, but my brother lived in Hawaii. So whenever I go out on vacation, I go check up on what's going on and stuff. And I had a chance to go around and talk to growers and say, what do you think about this? You know, it's going to be GM papaya, are you going to sell anything afterwards? And I said, to a person, they said, well, it's moot. Because if we didn't have the GM papaya, we had no papaya to sell anyway. Because they were being wiped out. And they created a variety called Rainbow, which during the process of rebuilding it from callus tissue, they actually picked a variety that had the lowest latex levels. And in blind taste tests, Rainbow actually performed a lot applicable in the papaya as they were growing previously. They actually released a better variety in addition to being virus resistant. Now the other one I talked about is hybrids. So a lot of the canola that's resistant and grown in Australia and Canada, resistant to a different herbicide. I won't go into details of that for a moment, but one of the key things about it is that they put in a hybrid variety. So this is an open pollinated variety, this is a hybrid variety. They spray both of these crops once with herbicide, as they usually have to do, to control various weeds. But then heavy rainstorms came through and they couldn't make the second application here. They never had to make the second application here because the canola, because it was hybrid, grew so fast, it was such vigor, it established a canopy to stop the weeds from coming through. So they got a 50% reduction in pesticide use just because of the things are hybrids. So this is happening out there. Nobody really talks about it very much. It's not that dramatic. There's no pesticide being used. But I could walk into canola fields in Australia and look under them, and they got about that tall. And I could tell whether it was a GM canola field or not by the presence or absence of spindly little weeds in the bottom. So it just happened. The canola variety closed out, canopy closed out, and that could beat the weeds. So I'll come back to that in a minute. Next, I'm going to talk about a trait that is the first novel one to be released since 1996, and that is drought tolerance. So Monsanto and DuPont have both released drought tolerant corn, and it's produced by using genes that promote stress response in plants. So it's complicated. It doesn't always work, and it works spottily in different fields, but they've done it, and some varieties do, under occasion, do spectacularly well. So this is corn growing in a drought. So these are the ones without the gene, and they're showing all signs of drought stress. The leaves are rolling tightly. Growing right next to them are plants where the leaves are still out and open and doing a great job of photosynthesis. And also, without the gene, the leaf temperature gets a lot hotter because they're not respiring properly compared to ones with the gene. You've got cooler leaf temperatures. And at the end of the season, in this particular case, the results were pretty dramatic. It's not always that good. In this case, it was pretty bad in terms of the improved yield we got. When I was an undergraduate at Davis, so somebody told me that in my lifetime, they could make plants where drought tolerant. I would have said, you're nuts. We know that's a complex trait. It's physical environment. You're never going to get there. And I'm pleased to say I've lived long enough to learn there are at least 8 different ways to do it. People are doing it in different ways already. It's a remarkable sprint in product technology. But here's another one. So if you go to Tabletop Mountain in South Africa, or in the courtyard behind the Botany Building at UC Davis, you can find this plant called Resurrection Plant. And it's really impressed me as an undergraduate, because come back in the summer, these plants look dead. One technician from BioLabs came out, pour a couple pitchers of water on them, and 10 days time, they looked healthy again. They would be alive. It was resurrected. And the way it does it, molecular biology has been curious about this for a long time, it synthesizes a sugar called trehalose into the cells, and that stops various parts of the machinery, like chromosomes, from breaking up. Just protects them. You add water again, it gets more turbid, the water comes in, fills things out, and the plant takes off again. So they thought, can we do this in plants?
So they put the trehalose genes. These are tomato plants that have been drought stressed. This is what happened about 3 days after water had been added again, and that's a couple weeks after water.
Which one's GM? So you wonder why you should do this, because, okay, when the plants are looking like this, they're obviously not growing anywhere, so why would you keep this one going? Well, in places like Southern Australia, they often have a good growing season up until about August in their winter growing season, August and winter, and it'd be a month drought, just as the grain is starting to fill out. It'd be stopped, and then they lose everything. Looks great the first couple of months, and then it's heartbreak. What if you have a plant that can shut down? And then, oh, and worse than that, even more insulting, then they get rains a month later. Right? What if you have a plant that can just shut down and wait until it rains? It wouldn't give you full yield, but at least you get a crop.
So that's what this could do. And one of the other big ones is nitrous oxide. So a little bit of the fertilizer you apply metabolizes off in the atmosphere as nitrous oxide. Or 300 times more important than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. And even if you don't, not too impressed with climate change arguments, at least as importantly, it means that nitrogen, which costs money and energy to synthesize and deliver to the field, some of it's getting away without being used by the plant. So there's a really important reason to be concerned about the inefficiency of this. So what happens? So people playing around with plants, just trying to understand how plants work, discovered a way of improving nitrogen efficiency. So this is one that has a nitrogen use efficiency gene in it. That's the one that's got the gene. That's without the same amount of nitrogen applied, with and without. What it does is it involves an enzyme called alanine transferase that just improves the mobility of nitrogen through the plant. And it does that. So one of the things I've been thinking about a long time for the advantages, in the 5 years I was the director of National Weed Center in Australia, I really came to realize the only way we were going to reduce herbicide use around the world is to make crops more competitive. What if you were to take water use efficiency, nitrogen use efficiency, and hybrid technology, put those in plants, and just try out these weeds? So not only is it going to help reduce yield, increase yield, it could be an avenue to greatly reducing the most widely used form of pesticides, herbicide use. And what else are people doing? So in Adelaide, Australia, we're working on iron-rich rice. Iron is a major limiting factor in a lot of populations. Jim Dale, who is a colleague of mine on the Genetic Manipulation Advisory Committee, has been working on putting edible vaccines in fruit. So he grows banana trees that got vaccines in them. So you can plant a banana, which are clonal, don't spread pollen, don't seed. Plant a banana in the village, people kids can eat it to get their vaccine in places where you can't deliver vaccines otherwise to lose an after refrigeration. So you'll go back to this list of key issues. We're saving soil and water by roundup ready crops. Embarrassed as I am to admit that, but it's actually happening. We're reducing energy use because we're not tilling. We're not running across crops with sprayers to control the insects. We're reducing a lot of pesticide use and potentially reducing use of fertilizer in the future. We've got a lot less fumonisins in corn, and people are making more money. You know? Generally, the things that come out already is actually doing pretty well. And there's others on the way. That one's out already. These are ones that people are looking at. Salt tolerance is looking really promising. There's already vitamin A. Rice has been held up for a long time. So things are happening out there in terms of these crops. So earlier we were talking about fake facts and how they affect the biofuels and how it's that. So we seem to be getting used to fake facts a lot these days, but it's something that's been affecting public sentiment about GM crops for a long time. A lot of things people believe about them, they just aren't true. That's not to say there aren't restraints. So in addition to opposing the first corn application in the United States, I also oppose the
gives you actually ground resistance in the turf grass for golf courses. I'm explaining why, if anybody's interested. There's a group in Australia that wanted to put DT genes into sorghum, and we stopped them from doing it because sorghum is a major refuge crop. The insect has a crop in Australia. So there are, people always come up with ideas that probably aren't good, but the ones that have actually raised horses are nothing that are pretty sensible. And generally useful to really stop them on. But thank you very much. Question, because for a long time the wheat industry didn't want to know about GM. I was at a meeting in Saskatoon about 15 years ago where a Canadian wheat board said, we don't have anything to do with Brantford wheat. Somebody came back to the audience said, what about if we provided Caesarean head lighting systems? And the person paused and said, we have to think about that one. So it's probably going to be a matter of getting the right trade. Monsanto offered, and we kept them on, not to lose ground of wheat, but the wheat is treated because all the area already is treated with, pretty much is treated with round of application before planting. And they didn't see there being a financial advantage to it. So they agreed to a policy of the Gulf and Australia where they're only going to release ground of ready canola and ground of ready pop. If it was the drums in the areas. And that was to make sure they didn't have a lot of ground of being used repeatedly crop after crop. We gave them the same advice that the United States got, not putting ground of resistance in the corn, where we rotated either soybeans or corn, soybeans or cotton, and they did depleting the corn, so it's backed up, and they had big problems with resistance around as a result if we had experience in Australia. So some things are good ideas, some not. Wheat's a good one, but I think it's, the industry has actually realized one of the things that happened because of the insect resistance is the corn belt has spread west in the United States, and wheat growers have even realized that they're losing. We certainly got to say, wait a second, we're losing water because corns are being gangbusters and we're sitting still in terms of productivity. It's because the European corn borer isn't damaging the tissues inside the corn, that it's actually more drought tolerant and can survive in the tougher conditions, yield well in the tougher conditions. Yep.
Yes. What do you think is the future of genetic modification?
Interesting you ask that because the first.
Did you repeat the question?
Yeah, sorry. What do I think about possibly a genetic modification of plants that are used in indoor agriculture? An interesting question because the first genetically modified crop released in Australia was not cotton or canola, but carnations, blue carnations developed by foraging. And they're still, people are still growing. There's been no controversy about it at all, so there's no reason you couldn't take flower. You know, there's lots of things you can do flower varieties, for example. To increase the variation. Probably like CRISPR, this new technology that allows you to selectively delete the modified bits of these genes. So simple, we'll have undergraduates doing it. And undergraduates could create new floral varieties. And probably, you know, if we don't, if we can keep the rate of genetic regulation to a sensible level, we probably have a whole range of new horticultural varieties as well, things like that. Yeah.
I think you've done a terrific job of explaining that the science does not. We've got to worry about. But you mentioned that some of these things are spreading themselves, and you showed a map with India and parts of Africa, and it seems that the problems there are more socio-economic.
Yeah.
This is, after all, intellectual property that's owned by the people who produce it and need to control it. Is there going to be hope in that area?
Actually, it's not as big a problem as you think. So I organized a meeting once in England that included the major players producing genes for corn. And I was trying to persuade them to work with us to make sure that when BT corn was released in Africa, it had two BT genes instead of one. And I thought I was going to have all kinds of problems. You know, I was prepared with all kinds of ideas that I was patent just to work. And the minute they talked to me, it's great my memo, and they all talked to themselves among each other before they got to the meeting, but basically they said that's not going to be a problem for us. The only thing they wanted, the only guarantee they wanted what held up the agreement was a guarantee that if this corn was grown in Africa and got to Europe, somebody would sue them. They're prepared to give away the technology. They realize they're not going to make any money off the system from GM. Years ago, Monsanto gave a virus and insect resistant potato technology in Mexico. Because they said it's not a commercial market, they never gave anything like that.
But there are these issues in India where small farmers are killing themselves because they've been saving seeds and they've been arrested.
Yeah, it's small, but it's real.
Now, actually, there was a paper about this recently where somebody looked at it and said it doesn't look like it's any different than before the injection. So people are saving seed, probably against it. But the biggest problem with saving seed is saving it, and they're creating a very mixed pool of what varieties are in the field, and probably, from my perspective, the biggest risk is those accelerated variation of this insect. We'd rather they didn't save it. There has been a big problem with bone suicide and a lot of it's probably blind pesticides having failures. But yeah, something came out about that recently, and they said it doesn't look like it's been any worse since the injection of BT rather than not. Yeah.
I'm a biochemist and a molecular biologist. And I see the tremendous positive things you present.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have this visceral feeling like I don't want some pointing at the scientists.
Yeah.
You mentioned a little bit about, I think, golf course turf grass. Is there, are there any general principles or there any specific examples where you say, that's a place we shouldn't go, or that's a GM modification we shouldn't make? Or is the universe unlimited?
There have been, so for cultural reasons, there's been a lot of concern about releasing GM rice in Japan or GM corn in Mexico. There's actually GM corn growing in China. It is in field trials and some foreign food like seed pack.
More of a pure food?
Yeah, so for plant for food, it seems that in some countries where there's a particular grain crop that's associated with sort of natural identity, there's a cultural resistance, and that's fine. Mexicans are importing. This is really coming to the news lately over the arguments over the wall, but Mexico imports an awful lot of American corn, and now it gets over in Argentina to get it. But so they have no problem importing BT corn. But still, the local land race people want to be dealing without BT, and for supposedly. There's some evidence Mexican growers are doing what they've done for centuries and bringing corn down to their own experiments, all the other people want to go on. But I think to your greater point, yeah, we should tell people what's in the food. And I actually prefer that GM corn is labeled. I like to buy my corn chips from companies and only use GM corn.
Isn't that really the barrier to wheat? Because it's such a broadly traded food commodity that the Australians don't want to go at a marketing disadvantage to the Canadians and the U.S. And really, that's what's nobody wants to lose its marketability.
That's true. But one of the things that's been one of the issues is nobody wants to be the first one on the wheat market with GM for fear that they'll be asked to take a price penalty. So that's been part of the issue. Interestingly, there's in the grape, wine grape business, there are viruses like family virus. And in California, there's Pierce's disease. And people are beavering away in the laboratories, creating varieties, or some of these captivated varieties, they're resistant to them. In France, in the United States, they're nobody in Australia, nobody wants to be the first release.
But those are all a step away from what people think as food. I mean, part they consume rice and wheat. All these other things are step away from that.
Could be. I mean, a lot of corn, although you can buy decent sweet corn, and people have done trials in Canada and the U.S., some of my friends have run these trials. It's kind of sweet corn. Go out to the farmer's market. You'll have BT corn, conventional corn, and organic corn. And I'll tell people what's all involved in BT corn you feel if it's sold anyway. And in California, one of the things I've worked on in California and in Australia, particularly it's looking at coexistence of organic and non-organic or GM crops. And I don't have any price. For me, it's market access. Different farmers can do different things to mark out the quality. There was farms down in Hanford, California, were growing Roundup Ready conventional and organic cotton in the same farming operation. And selling their organic cotton in Patagonia, which came down and stepped in another year, they had no problem doing all three things. In the same farming operation, you're just charging them because you're organic cotton, and much higher weed control costs. So there's nothing necessarily, in Australia, a big trial of looking at how far canola fields have to be separated, so if you have organic and non-organic canola fields, it's in conventional canola fields. If you look at the largest pollen field study ever done, looking at herbicide use. So you can do all this.
Potential dangers in the economic self-interest are creating a monoculture.
Yeah. No, I think monoculture is a terrible idea, full stop. But it was after long before You know, the greatest threat to see Teosinte's conceptual populations in Mexico is not GM corn, just corn. People just planting monoculture corn. It's not really being driven by GM, but it is an issue for agriculture.
The economic incentive to grow the profitable crop lends you. The Irish grew that potato because it was a big potato.
It was a major food source. It was the best food source. People should diversify. That's one of the problems we have with corn rootworms in corn. It's increasing the problem in the Midwest, and what they really need to get in control is to diversify. As long as corn prices are not are maintained artificially high, there's too much supply to depend on our corn. China's doing this with food security. I talked to some Chinese officials. That's not it. You see, they're much more concerned about making more money internationally than they are about Chinese food security. That's the real reason behind the merger. But because of that merger, I mean, what's already happening is companies like Monsanto and Dow are just trading licenses. So if anything, the problem is not that the IP is going to be popped up. But too much of the IP is being combined in the same variety. So people are planting corn that has traits they don't need. Like, they don't need, in some cases, they don't need all that level of insect resistance, and they're only select the resistance factor. So the problem with anything is the commodification of different traits. There's a trading licenses, and there's only three companies. If they don't own it already, they just have to trade it with somebody else.
But for example, do you see China becoming a much stronger player, maybe to the detriment of the U.S.?
Yes.
Do you see the EU?
Yes, I think China, when you go through Chinese labs, I get a lot more a gene involvement. The oppression has to come away from because they're doing far more in this than we are, by a long time. And that the real challenge would be eventually, if the Chinese really want to be serious about enforcing IP at all, we'll be buying the technology from them, not Monsanto. I think that's the real threat, is that things have been so limited in the United States. You walk into these labs, and we've got teams of students just churning away basic plant and microbiology data. We were in Melbourne, we were trying to recruit Chinese students from the University of Melbourne. And we went to China Ag University, it was embarrassing because they had better facilities than we did. And they have better facilities than I have in Melbourne at Penn State. So, it's a big issue. And part of what's happened is, I think I've come around to the view that even as I serve as regular ones, we've overdone it. The regulations are too tight. We have these crops out there for 20 years. And the one thing that's actually gone bad is a chronic problem for agriculture is the evolution of resistance to some GT crops in a lot of cases around it. Right? Which we had that problem before GM crops were gone too. But all the other things we thought could go wrong, including multiple resistant crop varieties being weeds and crops, none of that's happening. We were overly far, way too conservative.
I've been shocked how slowly GT resistance has come along. That's what it might be a lot.
Yeah. Mississippi. Mississippi, in 1996, when the first introduced BT crop was in the midst of an outbreak of tobacco bugworm, which used to happen every 6 or 7 years as they evolved to this new class of insecticides. They introduced cotton varieties on broad scale in Mississippi, even though they weren't the local adaptive varieties that growers gave up the old potential for doing it. It was another couple of years before they got the ideal varieties in Mississippi. But since 1996, about 90% or more of Mississippi and Alabama cotton production has been BT. We've lasted over 21 years now without resistance evolving in crops. No previous technology since the introduction of DDT in 1945 has lasted that long. So, and I think, part of it is we did it for companies and we created that DDT being derived.
Do you think we'll ever make any progress on being able to put, for instance, the ability to fix nitrogen into
actually
using these techniques?
Yes. So the people working on this at Stanford since 20 years or so. But there's a couple of people with Davis that are sort of on threshold, on high authority, talking about that we can feel like it's pretty close to being able to get a conversation before. And they found, what part of the key was they found some unusual corn varieties in Central America. Any other questions? If not, let's thank Dean Crowder.
Thanks all right for coming.